session number 21564, wheel 8.
Colonel Cormac, wheel 8.
We were discussing Operation Commando. Do you have any notion of how far you advanced during that operation?
At the time, I didn't. It was over a period of 2 or 3 days. I would say at the most 2,000 or 3,000 yards, but without consulting a map, it would be difficult to be more accurate.
But at the time, you couldn't really get an impression of distance.
No, we went from objective to objective, as it were.
Were you advancing by tactical bounds?
Roughly, yes. And we were there in support, and it was the infantry that were going to take the objectives, supported by the 8th Hussars, the artillery, of course, and ourselves, who were actually with them on the ground, and from one hill to another. And it moved across, and this was basically on the north side of the River Imjin. And as far as my memory says, it was the last of the sort of mobile operations when we moved. After Op Commando, it seemed to settle down into ever more comparable with the First World War, when we had two lines. There would be key features in between the lines that people thought they should occupy, and there were fairly bloody battles over those features, which would dominate, as they used to say, no man's land, and key for the defence on both sides. But that was after Commando. we enjoyed Commando very much, because you could actually feel this was an offensive operation with a purpose, and we were all slotted into a team. And we lived and worked very closely with, in my particular case, it was A or R squadron of the 8th Hussars, as they called it, D company of the KSLI. There was a gunner FOO there, and myself as a sapper detachment commander. And it was a very nice, it was a forerunner, if you like, of a combat team or small battle group, that sort of thing, although these terms were not mentioned in those days. And one felt a great satisfaction in teamwork. When the lines settled down, and as a background, the armistice talks were going on, or dragging on, I think, at Panmunjom, that was the time when it was very cautious. Don't give away anything. Try and make them realize that we were still there and could hit them if you wanted. That's my impression at the time. And ever-increasing defence work said it was after Commander that we really went into the mine-laying and minefield-laying in a big way. After, most people, and certainly the infantry, were very grateful for all the mine-laying that we did, protective and defensive mainly, because we were always aware of the numerical superiority of the Chinese in attacks, and anything we could do to slow down their advance, cause casualties, while we improved our firepower and so on, would balance the thing out. So mine laying, regardless of how people feel nowadays, was an essential part of it and a highly regarded part of our defensive operations. There's just a brief summary of what I felt at the time.
Before you embarked on the advance in Operation Commando, had you done any working up exercises or rehearsal exercises with those subunits whom you were supporting?
No, we didn't. We just met up virtually. We were given our orders almost independently, and I really met the troop commander of the 8th Hussars in our squadron that I was directly with at that time in the forming up place. Luckily, I'd met him before from Sandhurst days. I think I mentioned that point. And we slotted in, and we had a pretty fair idea what we were supposed to do, and they knew what they were going to do, and we just fitted in together, and they called us for help. I mean, a simple thing like a tank on the side of a hill slipped off its tracks. They had, every tank had a small demolition charge for cutting the tank track where necessary, and replacing it with a spare link. But they were not all that happy about using explosives. And because we were there, that was one of the little jobs that we did. And then they rolled up the tank track. We blew the damaged bit, and they managed to insert another track, and then you drove on over the new of the track and wound it on again. It didn't take very long, but that was a simple thing to make sure that a tank wasn't out of action for a silly thing like a broken link. But that was just a for instance that I remember happening. Otherwise, it was searching and looking for booby traps in positions that were not captured. When D Company that I was with, they got a pole position, we would have a look around quickly to make sure there was no wires or obvious booby traps that the Chinese had left behind, that sort of thing.
Did you find many booby traps or mines in the...
No, we didn't. No, not really. I think they may have been taken by surprise and didn't have much time to do anything, but it was always a possibility, because they were quite good at ambushing people with mines, usually improvised, or the Russian ones I mentioned earlier.
Did you see the sort of tactic the infantry were employing? Were you able to actually observe how they went about advancing to contact and approaching and attacking?
Yes,
positions.
Basically fire and movement. And the company commander was well up. I mean, Jimmy Cottle got a DSO for his efforts in that operation, was very much up there with the platoon commanders, most of whom I knew personally, again, from my Sandhurst days, which was... It made it so much easier to fit in and get along with things.
Do you remember if they were using fire and movement in the sense of having in each section a Bren group and a rifle group, or if they were moving in half sections, or if they were pepper potting, or did they use all three techniques according to the ground?
It mixed up, but by and large it was platoon groups that were going forward,
yes.
Perhaps two with one covering,
yes.
And it was essentially fire movement.
Yeah.
Not necessarily, I didn't see it at the section level,
yes.
Which was what I had been taught at school in the OTC. But it was certainly platoons moving forward, having been given cover and fire from somewhere else, another platoon. Yes, that was the way forward. Everything was covered like that.
Were they doing flanking attacks, left or right flanking, or were they...
Where possible, yes. Yeah. Sometimes direct, but mostly it was flanking or sort of flanking. Flexible was the word I would use. And they were readily adapted to the ground, and a well-trained rifle company could manage that without any difficulty. It was almost second nature to them.
Does that mean the soldiers were able to carry out these movements without being given direct orders?
Oh, yes, yes.
So it was automatic?
It was almost automatic. Platoon commanders giving their orders, then all they would do would encourage section commanders who were perhaps a bit hesitant, but there wasn't much of that. They were all very keen to get on, because this was a nice change to be going forward in an offensive operation with a purpose to maintain our position north of the Imjin and make it more secure. It was clear what the tactical objective was.
What sort of support did the tanks give to these infantry attacks?
It was direct fire support on positions, and almost suppressive fire. The artillery had given the fire almost beforehand, up to the time of advance, so they would pound the enemy positions, but the most direct fire would come from the KSLI 3-inch mortars and the direct fire from the 20-pounders, I think it was, in those days, of the Centurion tanks.
So they're using main armament for
yeah.
that. Yes.
And the machine guns,
and machine
too.
Gun as well. Mm. Roughly, how close to the enemy defensive positions would the tanks get when they were giving that close support?
It's difficult to say exactly, but it would be a matter of, in some cases, up to 100 yards, 150 yards, quite close.
to be shooting the...
Yeah, because infantry. At that point you couldn't always be certain whether the Chinese had gone or not.
I was going to say, how would the infantry signal to the tanks that it was time to stop firing so they could make their final rush?
It was fairly visual.
Fairly visual. Mm. I mean, did they use vary lights or field sign or...
Radio.
Radio?
Yeah.
Ah, so did they have radio down to section level at that stage? Or
No, down to platoon. It was but 88 sets, and then Jimmy Cottle would have the tanks on his net, or he would be on their net, whichever the case was.
So the platoon commander would see where the section leading elements were, and he'd be able to...
He would be reporting back, yes. That we've now got to point so-and-so, or where it was all, you know, point 227.
Yes.
Or that thing. That was how we identified them, with the heights on the grid references, or the survey points on the map. They were all known as 355, 227 were numbers that, well, you'll never forget. 355, which was the main objective, was otherwise later known as Little Gibraltar, because it was a fairly substantial thing. So you could give your report lines by, I've now reached point so-and-so, and that was, everyone was in the picture virtually.
How close would the infantry get normally before they'd launch their final rush? Because at one time the tactics were you'd get within grenade throwing range and then throw grenades and then run in.
For the final assault. If they could, it wasn't always as clear cut as that, because there was a certain amount of smoke and with all the fire going on. But they would get as close as they could before running in, because the longer you have to run in, the more trouble you might get into.
There's more time for the enemy to shoot at you.
To react. Yes. So you would get as close as you possibly could before the final charge. Yes. And the ground, by and large, was hilly, allowed that manoeuvre.
Did did D Company suffer a lot of casualties during the operation?
Not many, no. Mm. Our casualties, as I recall, were fairly light. I don't think there were... I'll leave that.
What about your sapper group? Were they...
We had no casualties.
None at all?
No, not at all.
Was there any anti-tank fire or coming back, or any artillery from the enemy?
Artillery fire from the enemy, artillery and mortar fire, but no anti-tank fire that I can recall. And they had no air support at that time. That was very comforting, that we had, to all intents and purposes, complete control of the air.
Did you get close air support during this advance, during commando?
Not a lot of it, no. There was some. We all had our panels, our recognition panels, which I mentioned before, I think, which, when you stopped, that was the first thing you, on the reverse slope, on your own side, you put out these panels, which theoretically would make sure your own side didn't give you an airstrike in error. But that, of course, did happen once or twice. Most famously earlier on with the Argylls, when Kenneth Muir got his VC.
You were saying that soldiers knew what they were doing, that there would be a tactical advantage. Can you remember what you were told when you were briefed before joining the armour and the infantry for this operation?
Well, I knew what they were going to, that their aim, the objectives that they had, and it was usually at battalion level that the KSL as a whole were going to take this feature and that feature. I wasn't strictly aware of which company was going to do what at that time. And indeed, at my level, which was a half troop that I had at that time, I was really following, as I was told, the company commander and the squadron commander. What happened at battalion headquarters, I was not aware of at all. The squadron and company headquarters was as close as I got to finding out what the overall thing was. It was, you know, worm's eye view, if you like.
It seems you did have a fairly good general knowledge of the overall situation.
I knew what the general picture was and what the aim of it was. We'd been told that by my CO and squadron commander had briefed us all on that side. But that was a very general briefing, and we could tell, by the way, that the things were going well. That was an impression we got, and we were I think there was an air of confidence about the whole thing, which was stimulating.
Within your little combat group or battle group of the arm of the infantry and the engineers, who was actually in overall command? Was it the infantry company commander or the centurion tank troop commander?
I can't remember. I think I spent most time with the armoured, with the 8th Hussar Squadron commander and his headquarters. More time with him than with the D Company commander.
He was further forward, wasn't he? Yeah. No. But then were you in support or under command? Can you remember what
in support.
You were in support.
Yeah. And just do what we could, really. And anything with a sapper flavour, then we would be ready to jump in, or anything else that we were asked to do.
And did you contemplate getting involved in doing infantry work?
Because you'd not, done, not at that stage, yeah, no.
You'd done it in the line, though, hadn't you?
We had before and after done it in defensively, yes.
Yes.
But we were never asked to be infantry in the assault.
Could you have done that if you'd been
We'd have had a jolly good go. Oh, yes, we'd have had a go. But we were never asked to do that.
What happened at night? Because you mentioned this operation went on for several days. What would you and the rest of the troops involved in this operation?
Well, the first thing to do was to dig in, we became fairly adept at digging simple slit trenches fairly quickly, because there was always report that there would be a counterattack. We were always expecting a counterattack. And so defensive perimeters were immediately formed, and we had our part in that. And then there was the O groups. And then some people were asked to operate at night, or then you had a rest and caught up with some sleep and got some food. That was the sort of things that were happening.
Did you have any enemy attacks or patrol activity at night that you were aware of?
No. We were expecting it, and there were reports of it coming in, which kept you on the alert, and I can remember years later teaching field defences at the School of Infantry and showing them how slit trenches and battle trenches should be dug with appropriate cover and how long it would take to dig them to this shape and size. And I used to reflect back that we used to beat all the standard times for digging holes because the pressure was greater, but the trenches were pretty rough and ready. But I can remember digging at a great speed.
What shape were they? Were they just an oblong?
Yes, just a rectangle, as near rectangular as one could.
Yes.
But you knew that you were only going to be in there that one night. Well, you hoped you'd be one night, and then the next day you would be moving forward again.
How deep would you go then for your overnight slit trench?
Oh, 3 or 4 feet. Depending on the ground and the time, but enough to get below cover, mainly so you could lie down and if there was any mortar fire or shell fire, that you would be safe.
Were these one-man slits, or did you
two,
have any,
two-men?
Two-men slits.
We didn't, by and large, ever go in for one-man slit trenches. The foxholes that the Americans were quite fond of, we did not go in for those.
Who did you share your trench with normally?
That was my batman.
But you both dug.
We both dug, oh yes. Yeah.
What happened to the armour at night? Did the armour stay with you within your perimeter or go back?
By and large, hull down on a reverse slope and fairly standard. Yeah. And they were not. They were in danger from our Chinese or North Korean artillery, but they say there wasn't much in the way of anti-tank weapons in action against them. It was artillery fire and mortar fire that was the worry.
Did you get an impression of the sort of strength of the enemy in their defensive positions during this move forward?
I didn't have any real impression. Mm. We knew that there were lots of them, but they were very good at field craft. I rated their field craft very highly. They could move very rapidly, and they in the same way they appeared out of nowhere when they were attacking. They melted away when things were difficult.
And you didn't see them, or did you sometimes
We saw a few of them, but it gave no impression of the total numbers involved. I couldn't hazard a guess at that, from my experience at that time. Mm. I don't want to be coloured by subsequent reading of
course not.
These,
yes.
these events.
But did you get some impression from when you were looking at their possessions, which you mentioned doing, I mean, did that give you some idea of how many there might have been actually in residence holding the ground?
No, I wasn't thinking of that at the time. Yes. Yeah. Their positions were readily adaptable for our needs.
Yes.
The damage that our artillery and mortar fire caused could quickly be sorted out. And then they were reinforced and refurbished as best they could, depending on how long we were going to be there. When we finally got up to 355, 227, I think were the numbers that stuck in my mind, and there were others, then we knew that was the limit of our advance for commando. And then, of course, we set about improving and modernising or updating their field defences for our own needs.
What needs to be done then? How did their defences differ from our own? What did you have to
do
to improve?
They tended to be more continuous trenches.
Yes.
Right round the feature. We tended, as a general rule, in principle, to have our trenches staggered, and you didn't have much in the way of crawl trenches or communication trenches, unless that would be developed in time. But the Chinese seemed to go for trenches all the way around with key points where we would put a two- or three-man rifle group or a Bren group. They were effective.
How deep were they, these continuous trenches?
They would be down to 3, 4, 5 feet.
Did they have traverses across them, or were they simply a line?
It was almost like following a contour around.
Yeah.
And then where they had a position as such, as it were, as opposed to communication, that would be slightly more elaborate. And there would be a bunker dug into the hill behind them.
Were they well revetted?
No, they didn't go in for revetting very much. Nor did we, as a general rule. That later on, in the year after commando, yes, then revetment and other overhead cover strength, which I mentioned before, came into effect then, because with the pounding that you got from the Chinese artillery in later months, then you really had to make them as strong as you possibly could.
What about wire? You mentioned the Chinese could put out mines sometimes, or they could put out booby traps. Were their defensive entrenchments wired in?
Not very much, no. Mm. No, they didn't. They didn't use wire anything like the extent that we did.
Where they did use it, how was it actually employed, and what sort of obstacles could they?
Just very, very simple wire obstacles. It was something that they didn't think was either necessary or didn't believe in. I'm not quite sure which, but it wasn't very much. It was almost like a cattle fence sort of thing that you might meet occasionally. But they didn't bother with that, because it meant bringing wire up in quantity was a great administrative burden. And they didn't, as a general rule, burden their logistical supply with things like wire. It was ammunition of various kinds, and the basic food ration was what they brought up.
And you mentioned also that on our side we used improvised obstacles in places. Did they go in for doing that?
They were much more likely to do use improvisation than the formal wiring structures that we would use. And we learned from them. We were always ready to modify and improvise, but they did it of necessity. We did it because we liked variation.
So what sort of things did they put out in the way of obstacles that were improvised and using local materials?
They were a sort of booby trap things. They were very fond of putting out signs saying, you know, come this way and surrender. There were a lot of that around, and encouraging us, and safe conduct passes. But booby trapping was there. They were very good at that. Various improvisations, which were much the same as ours, tin cans and grenades, that sort of thing. They had a lot of these stick grenades.
Yes.
of which I thought was a great advantage. We had the old 36 grenade, but they could wire those up and tie a wire to the safety pin and hope that you would blunder into it. That sort of thing they did. As a diversion, I was very impressed with the stick grenade, because you could throw it much further and more accurately than we could with our old 36 grenade. And it was reminiscent, I would suspect, of German grenades, in especially the First World War, but also World War II. They had stick handle grenades which could throw far and accurately.
The criticism of the German grenade was that whilst you could throw it further and more accurately, it didn't have the same sort of destructive power to it as the 36 grenade.
I couldn't be sure. I had no World War II personal experience of those, but I was just impressed at the range that the Chinese could hurl these things. We weren't too concerned as to whether they were dramatically more or less effective than ours. The fact that they were coming was sufficient, I think.
You mentioned leaflets and signs saying this way to surrender. Mm. Do you think that had any effect on any of the soldiers whom you encountered in Korea or whom you commanded?
No. The only effect it had would be that they would like to have them as souvenirs. Being well aware, of course, that they were probably booby trapped. But they all knew that, and as sappers, that was fine. We knew what to do, but they were useful as souvenirs. Yes, they didn't, I think they caused a certain amount of mirth and hilarity. I mean, I don't think anyone that I knew took them seriously.
Was there any other sort of attempt at psychological warfare on their side by
broadcasting loudspeakers?
Loudspeakers.
Yes, they used to occasionally blare out loudspeakers and say that Tommy, come and surrender, and the usual communist propaganda about imperialist lackeys and paper tigers, and you're just doing what the Americans want to do. Why should you suffer? They did that from time to time.
Did that have any impact that you were aware of?
No. Again, it was just thought to be rather amusing.
Did we do anything similar on our side?
No, we didn't shout out like that, so no. I mean, there may have been propaganda at a different level, but certainly on the ground, in the sort of frontline areas, no, we didn't try anything like that. Not even the Americans.
Once you'd got to the critical points, 227 and 355, did the Chinese simply retire, or did they try and take them back while you were in residence?
They counterattacked fairly vigorously until the position was seen to be established. Yeah. Then they withdrew, and then it was local counterattacks at a later date from a distance. And it was after that that the separation between the lines became more marked. And the gap between them varied according to the nature of the ground. It could be as much as 2,000 or 3,000 yards, perhaps, or then other places it would be down to a few hundred yards or less, depending on the ground.
When they made one of their bigger counterattacks, how would they actually go about doing that, as far as you could tell from your position on the ground? What would you be able to see or hear or observe or notice?
That's slightly outside my experience, because when the objectives for commando were reached and established, then we reverted back to our normal sapper command, and we didn't come up to join the infantry except for specific mine-laying occasions. We would help them with jeep tracks, we would help them with field defences, when requested, and we would do additional wiring for them, if necessary again. But that was their responsibility, and their assault pioneer platoons. So after the close teamwork of commando, then.